cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
I don't know about you, Katie, but last night, about 10 o'clock Eastern time, saw in my email, I had a message, opened it up, all caps headline from the Bloomberg Professional Service, Bob Iger coming back to Disney after retiring, Bob Chapek out. Wow was the only word that came to mind. Some other choice words came to mind as well, but this is a big deal in the world of media. We've got Felix Gillette with us. He's media, entertainment, and telecom editor for Bloomberg Business Week. He's also the author of the great new book. It's called It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO. He joins us via Zoom from New York City. Felix, what was your first reaction when you saw this last night?
It was pretty jaw-dropping. I had to close my fantasy football app and pay attention to what's happening in the media world again. Total shock, surprise, excitement. This is just a totally wild move. And I think underscores what a crazy time it is in the entertainment business and how challenging and tumultuous this transition from the cable era to the streaming era is going to be for pretty much every big player in the space, including Disney.
I'll admit, I was asleep at 10 p.m.
You had an early morning.
I was resting up for a big day of reporting for Bloomberg News. But so you described shock. Was anyone expecting this, or was this across the board shocking?
I think that there were definitely people calling for a change at the top of Disney, particularly coming off of this last quarter, which was really truly a disastrous quarter for Disney. And I think Chapek's performance during the earnings call left a lot of people scratching their head. You know, the Disney had announced this $1.5 billion loss on streaming for the quarter, which was, you know, way bigger than people thought it was going to be. And yet Chapek was really cheerful and sunny during that call. And so I think in one sense, people were thinking, okay, maybe this guy is in over his head. There's been all these series of missteps. There was, you know, his clumsy handling of the culture war issues down in Florida. There was this dismissal of Peter Rice, the head of television, earlier this year, which upset a lot of creative people in Hollywood. So there have been a series of errors. So I think the decision to move on from Chapek, I think, is not that shocking. It's really just the bringing Iger back, replacing his hand-chosen, pick to succeed him originally. For years, every time he's been out in public, people have asked him about, would you ever consider coming back to Disney? And he said again and again and again, like, no, I'm not interested. I'm not interested. So that part of it is pretty wild.
Never say never. I mean, Bob Iger's 71 years old. He was at Disney before he, quote unquote, retired. More than four decades. He was its CEO for 15 years. He oversaw some of the biggest acquisitions that the company made, including Marvel, Pixar, and other acquisitions. So, Felix, what does it mean for the future of Disney and what we can expect over the next 2 years, which is, from what we understand, what we'll see with Iger?
Yeah, I mean, I think the argument for bringing him back is this guy had a 15-year run that was seen as this incredible time for Disney, this great series of acquisitions he made. And, you know, we're at this point in this transition from cable to streaming where everybody is suffering because the linear networks that was making everybody profits are, you know, continuing to decline very quickly. The streaming services are essentially these huge giant holes of money at this point. People are just shoveling money into them. They're still not profitable. So I think it's a time when almost anything could be up for sale. I think we're going to see more consolidation in the space. People are going to have to team up further in order to survive this era. And I think the argument for bringing Iger back is you want that guy making those big decisions over the next couple of years. You know, you have some faith that he's going to make smart moves.
Well, Wall Street is definitely cheering. Both of you look at the shares. Also, at least one upgrade on this news. But tell us about the potential fly in the ointment here. The activist investor, Nelson Peltz's fund. What could potentially go wrong here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's plenty that could go wrong. I think, you know, part of it is, again, the thing that's kind of funny to me is, like, you know, Iger kept pushing back his retirement again and again during his previous reign. And he kept, you know, there was all this speculation about, you know, who's going to succeed you, or do you have a leader in mind? You know, who's going to carry this future company into the future? He really kept running off potential candidates. And then in the end, he picked this guy, Chapek, who left everyone kind of scratching their heads. Why'd you do that? And now, you know, on the one hand, it's great that Iger's back to deal with whatever acquisitions they're going to have to make in the next couple of years. On the other hand, now he's back in charge of picking another successor for the future of Disney. And it doesn't give you a lot of faith that he is very good at that process. So I think that's going to be part of the challenge that all investors are going to be looking at. Like, what is the plan beyond these 2 years?
Well, that's certainly the question that many people are going to have. But at least, as you mentioned, Katie, and you pointed to Disney shares up more than 5% right now, and they were as high as 9.9% earlier in the day. Felix Gillette, media, entertainment, and telecom editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. He's the author of the great new book, just came out earlier this month. It's called It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO, joining us this afternoon via Zoom from New York City.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've talked in the past about what it means for people who've been laid off from some of the biggest tech firms. I mean, we're talking about companies like Meta Platforms, Uber, Lyft, Salesforce, Stripe, and more. And we talk about it oftentimes in the context of what it means in the bigger picture of what it says about the economy. But there's a different way of looking at it that's really important, and it has to do with people who hold H-1B visas and what they're doing if they've been laid off. We've got Sindhuja Ragnarajan on the phone with us. She's senior investigative data reporter. Actually, she joins us via Zoom from San Francisco for Bloomberg News. You can read her story right now on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So Joel, how should we be thinking about these layoffs?
Well, one thing that really struck me with Sindhuja's reporting and company's reporting is about H-1B visas. And H-1B visas have been something that the magazine has written about before. Skilled workers that have largely been in the tech industry from abroad. And we're talking some pretty incredible stories about where a lot of these people come from. But the tech industry has really benefited from this workforce. But what's interesting is effectively it's a company sponsored. So the moment that any of these people get laid off or fired, it puts them in a really difficult place. A lot of these people end up with mortgages, childcare, all kinds of stuff because they're, you know, banking on a future here. Oftentimes putting permanent residency in motion at the same time. So Sindhuja, bring us inside this. Having seen this data, how significant of a hit to the tech industry are these firings having as it puts a lot of these people in jeopardy?
Joel, this is a very interesting question. So it's like hundreds of employees we know have been laid off just from Twitter and Meta, I think around 350. And I want to say it's an undercount because we're looking at people who have been posting on LinkedIn, putting their name out there in a crowdsourced spreadsheet or something saying, hey, I'm in need of a Visa sponsorship. The overall, like when we did our analysis, we realized just with like six companies, you know, that have been recently doing the layoffs, Meta, Twitter, Amazon, Stripe, Salesforce, and Lyft, we found that they just, the six of them employ 45,000 H-1B workers. That's an estimate we created based on our data analysis. And just between Twitter and Meta, we found hundreds of people who claim to be visa holders who have been laid off in the last few weeks. So it's a pretty significant number, you know, and it's in the hundreds for sure.
As you and our colleagues Brody Ford and Katrina Manson write, people who do hold H-1B visas who then become unemployed, they can only remain in the U.S. legally for 60 days without finding new employers to sponsor them. Do we know anything about the terms that these employees are given when they are laid off from companies because they face this special circumstance? Like, are they given better terms because they're on this kind of timeline here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that was the interesting thing we found while reporting the story. You know, we started out thinking of the story as like a human story. You know, what happens when you just have this few weeks, few months of deadline and you're trying to scramble for another job and a visa sponsorship. But what we realized is that some companies are doing better than others in terms of how they treat their immigrant workforce and what policies they lay out. For example, you know, we found that Twitter sort of didn't give a lot of assistance or support to these employees. And some other companies have like a little slightly better thought out policies. So for example, you know, your 60 day clock starts ticking after the last day that you've, you know, worked there. So if you could extend that last day, you know, if there's like a notice period given that you're going to be laid off, but after 2 months, so that gives like people 4 months, you know, 2 months when they're working at that company and then an additional 60 days. So if that can be a form of relief, and as opposed to saying, you know, you're laid off today and then, you know, we're going to give you severance for 3 weeks or whatever, or 8 weeks or something. And then, you know, your clock starts right now. So that extension of time is really important. And, you know, some companies, I think Meta has done that, particularly for immigrant visa holders. Lyft was another one. Stripe, when they wrote that email, I don't know if they offered a notice period, but they you know, definitely acknowledged that this would be very difficult for immigrant visa holders. And Twitter, you know, was sort of they didn't think through as much based on our reporting.
I noticed.
And, and there was you know, and when employees wrote to them, many of them were really confused about, you know, when does my clock start ticking? Does it start the day of January 4th when, you know, you've said that would be our last day, but, you know, we're not productive, we're not on the, are we on payroll, are we not? And, you know, like, is it going to be November 4th? And so there was like a lot of confusion amongst employees, and they got very little guidance, very little like immigration one-on-one counseling, or anything that says more definitively, yeah, this is the day you need to, this is your last day, or that is your last day. They just said, you know, you should consult your own immigration attorney. So I think, you know, employers, that's like the least you could do for this workforce. They've invested so much time in this country, like you mentioned, and, you know, at least give them like the most they can get so they can like succeed in finding that job, especially now at the start of a place when a lot of tech companies are instituting hiring freezes and holiday season when things slow down. So, you know, the more you can do for them, the better it is for them.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about the Indians because there are a ton of H-1B visa holders from India. Many of them, as we write in the story, have been here for years, and it seems like it's really hitting that country hard, these numbers, right? So whom did you talk to, and what did you learn from on the India quotient?
I think, you know, a lot of people who come on H-1B visas, like you mentioned, Joel, like the goal is to eventually, you know, get permanent residency and citizenship. And for a lot of folks, like, you know, you stay on H-1B for anywhere from 3 to 6 years, your company starts working on your green card application, they file it, and then you get your green card in, you know, I want to say anywhere between 1 year to 3 years or something of that sort. But with Indians and actually Chinese nationals, like you file that green card and there's like a huge backlog because there's this rule that says that, you know, you can own, every country is allowed to get only 7% of the green cards. And Indians and Chinese being a huge part of the tech force have, you know, immigrated on this visa in larger numbers. So, you know, particularly for Indians, you know, there are 7% of the green cards reserved for them every year, which amounts to around 10,000 green cards. And then there are 500,000, nearly 500,000, you know, holders who've applied for their green cards. So that, so only 10,000 will keep getting every year. And that backlog is huge and it's growing. So, you know, if you apply for your green card today, or if you applied for it in 2020, then the chances are it could take as long as you may not Sindhuja, get it in your lifetime.
We unfortunately have to leave it there. Sindhuja Ranirajan, Senior Investigative Data Reporter for Bloomberg News via Zoom from San Francisco.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We want to welcome in once again Shaheen Contractor. People who listen to the program are familiar with her voice. She's ESG analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She's with us once again in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, fresh off of her recent trip to the Conference of Parties 27. That's COP27, as it's known. Shaheen, good to have you with us this afternoon. You just got back from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Yep.
A resort town. I know you did a lot of working there and not resorting. Okay. maybe some resorting, maybe some vacation. I hope you had some fun. First of all, what was COP like? I know this was your first one.
So Tim, COP was like nothing I've seen before. It was, you know, this two-week conference where 40,000 people just descend to talk about climate. I don't think I've ever been in that kind of environment. It's like very focused. And there were so many interesting discussions, so many different things, especially around two things in particular. The first was really carbon markets. There was, you know, people who were great supporters, there were people who were great sort of disbelievers. And the second one was around companies' carbon reduction goals and the need to sort of just go beyond just paper decarbonization, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that debate there on carbon. What is sort of the rallying cry for the advocates, and what are the non-believers saying?
So when it comes to carbon markets, the goal is for companies to basically offset their own emissions by purchasing these credits from projects that remove carbon from the atmosphere. Mm. And basically the goal there has to be that sort of the price of carbon, the cost of carbon has to pay for that additionality. Sort of without that, the project might not have been viable, which makes it sort of an additionality. The people who are against it believe that a lot of this money is going to go towards projects that are already financially viable. It's like a, you know, a renewable project where it's cost competitive. It's going to be built anyway. There's no additionality. So the money is really going to nothing, I guess. So it's basically the point that you have to fund a project through offsets, which otherwise wouldn't have existed.
Okay, well, you cover ESG for Bloomberg Intelligence, yes. And a big part of your trip, of course, had to do with the way that you're writing reports about what you learned there and what investors can learn from the way that you know, ESG is being talked about at events like this. What's a big takeaway that you have for the Bloomberg Intelligence audience?
So the one thing is, and I've said this before, but before COP this year, before COP last year, companies are setting these carbon reduction goals at a pace we've never seen before. There were quite a few interesting talks that happened around actually sort of implementation. Like the UK, for example, had this new proposal during COP where, you know, if a company has a goal, they have to have a plan on how to meet that goal. I think that's the biggest takeaway. Even in our research, we find that out of the companies we've looked at, about 85% have carbon goals. But what do these actually mean? It's a huge gap.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I always think about. Like, how do you factor in goals such as that one when you're, you know, thinking about a company's ESG score?
Yeah, so that's really interesting because, you know, when carbon is material, like for sectors like utilities, really sort of environmentally heavy sectors, that's when actually having a goal could have some kind of financial impact. So I think it comes down to materiality. What are the sectors where carbon matters and how does it actually factor into your financial performance?
I want to talk bigger picture, COP, because you were there and I haven't gotten to speak to many folks who were there. Do you leave with the impression that it's useful to the extent that all of these countries are going to leave and go back and work to reduce carbon emissions so we ultimately see a reduction in climate change?
So, Tim, I'll be honest, you know, before I went to this, I was really skeptic. I was like, why? What is the point of gathering all these private jets and blah, blah? But then I spoke to a negotiator there, and he told me one thing. He said, you know, Shaheen, think back to 2015, right? No country had a net zero goal or had anything really to do with sort of climate ambition.
Yeah.
But look at where we are today. About 130 plus companies have net zero goals. So year to year, it's kind of frustrating. But over the big picture, we have achieved something, I guess, compared to business as usual, if you think about it. So
well, we're talking
I feel
about
better
it.
Now.
We're talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Exactly. See?
Are you optimistic?
Are you going next year?
I hope so. I don't know.
Are you optimistic, though, just in the last 30 seconds that we have?
I am. I think, you know, given what companies are doing, given what countries are saying, given some of the things we've seen, I think I definitely am.
Well, welcome back, and thanks for sharing some of your experience with us. That's Shaheen Contractor. She's Environmental, Social, and Governance Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Fresh off her trip from Sharm el-Sheikh, where she was there for COP27.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It's that time already. Less than 10 minutes to go to the end of trading here on this Monday, November 21st, 2022. Tim Stanovec and Katie Greifeld were live in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Let's get to our Drive to the Close guest. Eric Clark is portfolio manager at Rational Dynamic Brands Fund. He joins us via Zoom from San Diego. Eric, good to have you with us. How are you?
Hey, Tim, how are you?
We're doing well, thanks. It's good to have you back with us. So help us understand the way that you're viewing the markets right now. We're getting to the close of the year, sort of the final sprint to the end of the year. It's a holiday week. We're seeing volumes down, 23% right now versus the last 20 days on the S&P 500. How does the year end?
That one's a bit of a toss-up, to be quite honest with you, because we have tax loss selling, you know, at the end of the year, but we also have prices coming down to what I consider to be much more attractive than we've seen in a number of years. And so, you know, it's anybody's guess on the timing and when people do their tax loss selling, but we've certainly already done all that stuff, and now we're trying to pick away at some of the opportunities that tax loss selling is giving us.
Can I write off the rest of the year then and trying to...
You don't even have to come in, Katie.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get
okay.
to. I have been hearing more about tax loss harvesting, and what a brutal year. But I want to bring you into a debate we were having at the start of the program about the consumer, because we're going to get a lot of black data or Black Friday data on Friday after Thanksgiving. We know that the consumer is still strong here. When you see headlines and economic reports to that effect, what is your takeaway? Is that bullish or bearish for you when you think about what the Fed is trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, listen, the Fed is a whole different story that we could probably spend a lot of time on. But from a consumer, you know, when we are starting to feel squeezed, we start to make different decisions. We start to play the this versus that game. What do I need to buy? Even if I don't love the prices that are higher, what do I have to buy? I got to keep doing that. What can I defer maybe for now? If I'm feeling the pinch a little bit, particularly towards holidays, and you want to have good holiday spending. So I think we're in that period of consumers just making a decision about what to spend on and where to go and which brands are the most relevant. I mean, that's where we spend all of our time on brand relevancy. So we feel like that we have a good expertise in that area, but clearly the consumer's, you know, feeling the pinch a little bit with prices being up literally across every category that we see.
Okay, so that's the perfect segue to talk about what you're concerned with, and that's an earnings recession. Given what we've heard about from companies that have reported already, and we still got Zoom after the bell, but we're pretty much done with earnings season. Q4 is not going to look great for a lot of companies. Amazon, for example, already gave us a heads up about that target as well. What did you see, and what does that portend for Q1 2023?
Well, I think the thesis is the next shoe to drop is earnings will start to reflect all the things that the Fed has done, and that slowdown will be here. My problem is, you know, the valuations have been reset so much already. Who knows if it's a full reset or a two-thirds reset, whatever the number is. I suspect we have an earnings trough for the year, you know, probably reported in the April quarter. And historically, markets bottom 3 to 6 months before earnings and GDP, et cetera. And so, you know, if we're in late November now, the market probably has fully discounted, or at least, you know, almost fully discounted the earnings recession that I think everybody expects.
So does that mean we've hit bottom?
Well, I don't know that we've hit bottom. That's above my pay grade. I'm trying to find the right price points for the brands that we love. It's really hard. I think, you know, Michael Cembalis from JP Morgan put out a report. I think that 3,300, 3,400 on the S&P is a reasonable place to go. It doesn't mean we have to go there. It doesn't mean we stay there. But I think if we get to that level, you're going to see some, you know, multi-year wonderful buying opportunities. And sentiment is probably going to be dreadful if we get down there, but that's usually when the best buying opportunities happen, when it feels bad.
All right, Eric, I want to get specific here. I want to talk about the brands, the names that you're excited about. What are you looking at?
Well, I mean, we focus on a lot of trends. And so some of them are consumer trends, and that's not just buying and selling of goods and services. You know, we love this mega trend in alternative assets, people migrating a little bit of money from stocks and bonds into alternatives, real assets, infrastructure, private equity, all those things. Blackstone and KKR are the two biggest. They are fairly cheap now. The stocks have come off pretty meaningfully this year. I'm looking for really good snapbacks in 2023. within regular consumer spending. You know, I still like the athleisure, the Lululemons and the Nikes. They've come down pretty meaningfully. We still like the home. I know there's, you know, home sales have cooled off pretty dramatically with the Fed actions and mortgage rates rising. That just means that people are going to stay in their homes rather than move. And so I'm not surprised to see Home Depot and Lowe's still do pretty well. You know, inventories are up a little bit, but pricing power is really strong.
Eric, Tesla is on your list as well, thanks to the notes that you sent our producer, Paul, a little earlier today. I've got Tesla as one of my decliners today. It's down, another close to 6%, 6.5% right now.
Yeah.
Down more than 26% from when Elon's deal for Twitter closed. Why are you bullish on Tesla?
Well, we sold it much higher ago, and we just started nibbling, literally put a pinky toe in the water a little bit higher than where we are, and we'll start to – it's the smallest position in the fund. I just – you know, right now, the distractions that Elon has had with this Twitter, I think, are providing long-term opportunities. And so I'm going to be very slow and methodical to put money into Tesla as it declines. But anything under, I think, 150 – you know, between that 125, 150 level, I think are pretty good places to add to that name for the long term. But it's a teeny tiny portfolio position right this minute.
This is really interesting. The Tesla discussion, the Elon Musk discussion. I mean, we hear all the time as a bear case for Tesla that, you know, this is Elon Musk is a distracted CEO. Obviously, he's spread very thin with the most recent Twitter fiasco. How much of a concern is that for you? You say this is a long term sort of nibbling that you're doing, but how do you factor that concern in?
Well, I think that he is getting the message. Let's use Disney as a good example. You know, Bob Chapek probably wasn't the right guy. Bob Iger's coming back. Elon said he hates managing day-to-day business. Yeah. That's not core strength. He needs a Tim Cook-type operator to run Tesla, and he probably needs one to run Twitter. Let him be the kind of the chief information or innovation officer.
Right.
That's really – he's just doing too much. And I think he finally realizes he has to wait.
Eric, we got to run, unfortunately. We got to get you back. Eric Clark, portfolio manager at Rational Dynamic Brands Fund.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take. Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit bloomberglive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.